Hello, everyone, and welcome back to On Becoming. I can't wait to introduce you to my next guest, Priti Gill. She's quite a rare breed for a long-term Paris expat. For one, Paris was never her dream destination. And two, she really stands out among the culinary experts we typically hear from in France because of her very unique background. Priti grew up in the Punjab region of India and moved to Northern California when she was 10. And while studying abroad in Sweden during college, she met a Frenchman and fell in love with him and moved to Paris, where she's been living now for over a decade. Now, food has always played a very important role in Priti's life, but it wasn't until she moved to Paris and started studying more about food that she learned about its seasonality, rituals, technique, and artistry. And it was from there that a real passion sparked. In 2013, Priti created a food and travel platform called Little Life Table as a way to document her favorite food establishments and travel adventures. It was the success of that project that led to the launch of Harupi Media. Harupi Media is a digital creation company that creates story-driven content for food and travel brands who are really looking to connect to their customers through the soul and values of their specialties and stories. Priti is also the proud new mama of a podcast called Life on Time. In our conversation, we cover lots of ground, from Priti's fascinating relationship to food through family, how she wound up snagging a prize job at the Cordon Bleu. But we center a lot of our discussion on a subject that I find fascinating, how loss can be a fertile ground for spiritual growth and creativity, and how aspects of our identity can unexpectedly come into focus and really thrive when we pluck ourselves out of our place of origin. I really hope you enjoy this conversation and can't wait to hear what parts of Priti's stories resonate with you. Happy listening. Hello, Priti.
Hi.
I'm so excited that you're here with us today. So we've spoken about this podcast offline, and you know a little bit about what the concept is. So the idea behind the podcast is really to peel back the onion and kind of move our hands along the lesser known bumps and crevices and ridges of your transformation journey. So what that means is kind of bubbling up some of the hardships as well as the aha moments that have made you into who you are and are maybe kind of pointing the way towards who you're becoming more of, because the becoming journey is never complete, of course. So before we start our little conversation, is there any part of your journey that you're particularly interested in unraveling, that you'd like to leave this conversation with some more clarity around?
Well, first of all, what a great intro. You were so good at that. There's no specific thing. I will say, if I can kind of honor some questions that I get sometimes in through Instagram or by email, it's really that a lot of Indian girls have not seen other Indian girls in this space, maybe talking about food and exploring food. And so just a very general question I get is like, how did you get into this? How'd you get into, you know, gastronomy in France? And really, that's probably the only one where if I could provide any practical advice, that would be it.
That's super interesting. So kind of how you are occupying a place where you are representing a group of women in a way that is uncommon, that is a little bit refreshing and different, and you want to bring a little bit more information to how you wound up in the role that you are?
Yeah, like, you know, gastronomy in France is such an incredible space. It's, you know, French cuisine in general. And so I can understand if there's a girl who's Indian who maybe hasn't seen another Indian girl just speak about different restaurants and chefs and different cuisines that are represented in Paris, also working at Le Cordon Bleu, that could be interesting for someone who also loves food.
That's great. I mean, there's something that's so compelling about this idea of seeing a version of yourself that you might want to reach forward towards. And if you don't have that representation, it's much harder to imagine that that's a possibility for you.
So exactly. Exactly.
So, well, why don't we start?
Yeah.
Where you come from. I mean, it's always been part of the way I've known you without really understanding much of the detail of your background. So you were born and raised in New Delhi in India, and you moved to Northern California when you were 10. Can you describe the role that food played in your life growing up? Like, who was doing all the cooking, and did you feel that you had a special connection to food back when you were living in India, or did that kind of emerge later on in your life?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Food was not a very, it didn't stand out because it was so deeply just embedded in the day-to-day that it wasn't something that was, wow, look, we're doing this, because it was so common in India. In my family, I have a very large family. My dad has 7 brothers, 1 sister. My mom comes from a large family as well. So growing up, we always had family at our house, uncles, aunts, cousins, and mostly women did do the cooking. But I remember my dad and my uncles always being in the kitchen, like helping with something or doing something. Very specifically, I am Punjabi, and Punjab is in the northern part of India. And so it's important I say that, because Punjabi people, we love cooking. There's a very, you know, there's a particular cuisine that comes from Punjab. And so I just remember that food was present throughout the entire day. It was present in the morning when I'd have breakfast. It was in the evenings in dinner time. And it just was so common that it never felt like it was something that stood out particularly. I wanted to answer one of your questions, but you mentioned if it played like a specific role in my life growing up. Not in India. It was primarily when I moved to France that it started to play a more bolder role in my life, because in India it was just so common. And I had never really felt a special connection to food until I moved to France, because I started to learn about food. In India, it was really just the experience. It was so beautiful. It was like eating with family, going out after school. My mother would always take us to go get some fresh juice that was being made. It's very common to get juice, you know, from juice makers in India that have their carts. And it just was so real and natural and part of my life's flow. But it's in France where I started to really get a different education about it and started to learn about the origins, where the food came from, why it was served a certain way, seasonality. And so that's where the shift happened with a more awareness and education about food. It never happened in the US. It's like a blank space in the US. And it's actually really important, because now when I discuss food with my friends in the US, we all kind of feel that same way. I'm almost like angry, because I'm like, oh, I wish the food, you know, I'd learned more, or I wish I would have studied a little bit more about what I was consuming and why. And because that's what happened in France.
So there was like a pause on the food education or the food appreciation between when you left India and when you came to France. But I want to go back a little bit and talk about that. I think it's so interesting that you were a kid. You were just absorbing by osmosis this environment that you were immersed in. And it's like reminding me of kind of like a fish tank doesn't know that it's swimming in water. Like, you don't know that that is a special thing because it's so present. But once you have a little bit more of a break from it, when you have an opportunity to kind of realize that it's not in your life, that you can appreciate it. So I want to know, when moving to the States when you were 10. I mean, and I've seen that in a lot of the people I've worked with, and also for myself, you having that, you know, as you say in French, like recul, where you have that distance, you can better see and appreciate the things that are special to you and that make up the person you are, maybe your roots and your heritage. What did moving to the States reveal to you about where you come from, your heritage, your values, and maybe also living life with a double cultural lens?
Yeah, you know, when I moved to the States, it was such a great experience as well. My dad got this incredible opportunity to work in the United States, and it was just, it felt, however, very transactional, my day to day. And
what do you mean by that?
It felt like we now were, things had to be done in a certain way for everyone to achieve something collectively as a family, to achieve goals. And that was just right away as soon as we entered the United States. I also come from a family who's extremely, you know, I had a father with an incredible work ethic. And so when you move to a new country, you want to make sure that there's safety and that financially everyone's okay. And so all that really requires a plan and a strategy to a certain extent, you know. And so the state started to feel, it was this great experience to this day. It's been, you know, it was wonderful moving there. But I remember just thinking, like, speaking about food specifically, it wasn't like there was time carved out to go get special food in that day. It was like, okay, we've got to eat like dinner and this is what's for dinner. It just felt quicker. Whereas in India, it felt more oriented as far as like where we're going to go to the market to go get some food. Or, you know, there's somebody in India who goes around the neighborhood and he's called the Sabjiwala. Sabji means vegetables. Mm-hmm. And you go and you take your time, you get the food and you bring it home. In the US, it just kind of felt like, hey, we've got work, we've got, you know, we're gonna have dinner and then we are gonna go to sleep and then we're gonna kind of start that process again. And so it just started to feel like that, not as soon as I arrived, but through my adult years, that's what it really started to represent.
Yeah, so how that distance and the contrast helps you understand a little bit more about your heritage and your values and what living with a double cultural lens is about.
Yeah, you know, it brought me closer to my family because we wanted to protect what we had in India, eating dinner together. We really, it was continuous. There's nothing that got in the way of that. And I think that built a really strong identity for me being Punjabi, being Indian, because at home, it was always that. I also moved to Fremont, California, and there was a lot of Punjabis, a lot of Indian people. And so we were really part of that community as well. So I never felt like I really lost any part of who I was. Now, when you leave your home, you're in a different environment, of course. And so you're learning about America. You're learning about, you know, different cultural traits. And you're speaking English now. Whereas in India, I wasn't speaking English. I was speaking Punjabi or Hindi. And so little things like that, it did transform my identity. And I think because we moved to a city like Fremont, it gave us so much permission to continue to be who we were because we felt very supported in our community, not just by Punjabi or Indian people, but just in general by other Americans that we were living around, you know? And I remember feeling like now I wanted to learn even more about who I was because I'd kind of been plucked away. And so I still speak Hindi with my dad and in Punjabi. And it was just very common to not speak English at home and to speak like our mother tongue. So I felt like our identity actually got stronger because we wanted to continue to make sure we never forgot it.
Amazing. Do you think that was a decision your parents made consciously, or it was just kind of a intuitive? No, it was just like,
it was intuitive. My parents, I come from two parents who are very intuitive and were very in touch with who they were. And so I think it was just a very natural process for them. It was very natural. They never told me that you absolutely need to speak Hindi or Punjabi at home. It just happened. And if I wanted to speak in English, that was also okay. But there just was a lot of love and a lot of support around the idea of watering who we naturally were. And because that was such a beautiful part of who they were, they just continued it in what we ate, in our family still continuing to come over. In we went to the Gurdwara, which is the Punjabi temple that had just been built in Fremont, and we'd meet other families there. Just in general, I remember it was just such a deeper part of who we were. And, you know, I think for them, it was really hard. Like, they just left India, this place that they loved and grew up in. And now this was a new life. And so for them, they wanted to remember what that looked like and felt like still. And so any of those little moments that felt like home was embedded in our day to day. Little photos, little rituals, finding the Indian grocery store. I mean, at one moment, they ended up opening up a Indian grocery store. And
really?
Right across the street from Stanford, my mom and dad opened up the first Indian grocery store. I'm sorry, they didn't open it up. They continued and bought it. That was all, it was already existing. And so they decided to continue it because the guy was selling it. And all these people from India that were going to Stanford that didn't have family would come and buy all the groceries at our store. My mother would be like making rotis and paranthas in the back and like wrapping them up for the students. So it just was such a natural process of us moving. And also at that time, it felt very, we were given so much permission. Like I felt so welcomed. Felt so good.
It's such a refreshing, I mean, your version of immigrant family moving to America and being so embraced and having the space to continue to culture your heritage and what's important to you and feeling that kind of sense of belonging, even if you're not in your original place of home, you know, and for you and for your family to be able to experience it. I think it offers a very different narrative that we're used to about what it's like immigrant families moving to America.
Absolutely, Ziva. I feel very fortunate about our experience because I have spoken to other people and I know that their experience was different. And maybe now, you know, things have deviated away from what I experienced and they've evolved and changed. And so I do feel very fortunate and I talk about it with my family, but it was a very good experience for us personally. And I do want to stay mindful that I know other people have also had very different experiences.
Well, now I just have like this image of in my mind of you at the grocery store, like,
Well, I'd come home after school and I'd be helping my parents like pack the dal or the rice and all the spices. And I just remember that store. It was just so beautiful. And I couldn't believe that my parents like bought it. They knew someone who was selling it and they bought it. And they're like, we have an Indian grocery store. And they were working full time and they were coming home afterwards and opening the shop. And then my dad decided to like do the daytime. It was just so it was wonderful. And I think, again, it was an exposure to what I would have missed out on because I moved from India. And now I was like getting exposed to all the food again. And
right. It was kind of like a continued education over there.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other people that were coming in to get the food, they would start sharing their stories because my mom and dad would be there. And they felt like, oh, in India, it's very common to call your elders like uncle and auntie. So they'd be like, oh, Uncle G or Auntie G. And they just start sharing their stories. And that's when I really realized our experience was a little unique.
Because they weren't the same stories.
They would be sharing different stories. And so, it was interesting.
Okay, this is providing a lot more context. I remember one of the videos you posted of you and your dad shot like food shopping in Strasbourg. Yeah. And I thought that was so cute. And like you guys like going and picking up the different items. And I love grocery shopping in any place I'm visiting. Like that's my favorite pastime. But now I see a little bit more, maybe the connection that you and your dad have to kind of appreciating different items and brands and that experience of being in a store together.
Yeah, we love grocery stores in our family. My dad loves Costco. I love any grocery store. It just is such a great representation of kind of maybe what's going on in that city, in that state, in that country, because grocery stores change from one street to the next street, it's an experience no matter where you go, no matter what country you're in, no matter what city you're in, you know?
Yeah, I agree. It's a real like imprint of
exactly.
The identity in that very spot. I love it. Yeah. Okay. Well, we have to do some grocery travels together.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, in France, I'm just like, I'm in awe all the time. Even in the States, I love it. I love it. I love it so much.
Okay, so you had mentioned earlier that it was when you came to Paris that your education around food really kind of started to blossom. And it definitely feels like it would be a natural place for a food lover to emigrate to. Is that what brought you here?
No, I had been studying in Sweden for a year. So I went to San Francisco State. And in my last year, I decided to go study abroad in Sweden. And when I was living in Sweden, I had met someone at that time. Who was French. And with him, I came on over to France. And at that time, I had just gotten, you know, after doing everything, I just finally got the chance to be able to work in France. And a friend of mine said, hey, Le Cordon Bleu is, you know, looking for someone who speaks English, but who also speaks another language, primarily like Hindi, because they were opening up this new program called the Restaurant Management Program. Mm-hmm. At that time, I had started a food blog talking about different restaurants in Paris. I'd started taking photos and they had seen that. And so during the interview, you know, that kind of came up and I went into the interview. I was totally nervous. My French was completely awful. It's still awful, but still at that time, it wasn't that great. And it was a Saturday. The interview was on a Saturday and it was around 1 o'clock and I got home and at 5, I had a call and they said, you got the job. And I was like, what? Because this had been just a dream. It's a dream job to work at a culinary school in France. And that was really the time I worked at the Cordon Bleu for 5 years. And those were very formative years about learning about food. It wasn't just about French food. It was learning about the fundamentals of food, where it comes from, the seasons, the different techniques, the tools that we use, the patience, the time. It was such an art. It's such an art form here that it just revealed things to me that I didn't know I was interested in until I started working there. And then that added a layer of, okay, I come from India where it's such a beautiful, you know, way of living on a day to day. It's just naturally in our ways to eat collectively. But France introduced different ideas that were so technical that I had never explored with food, that I didn't know, you know, existed, because I'd never really done that research or wanted to do that research. And so those 5 years at Le Cordon Bleu were very, very interesting for me and my education around gastronomy.
So it sounds like you really, like you had a level of appreciation and love and poetry and just family connections with food, and this experience kind of lifted the lid onto a whole other just vast encyclopedia of knowledge that maybe you didn't even know existed, but it was like, wow, swimming in just the depths of it.
Yeah. And so I was working in the student services department initially. And then right as soon as I got there, within a few months, they said, hey, we really want you to take over the restaurant management program. And that really gave me permission to kind of go into the courses, into the classes, and really kind of see what the chefs were doing. and then organizing different trips for the students and taking them to basic, intermediate, and superior restaurants around Paris. So then that revealed different, you know, ideas, different menus, different dishes to me. And working at a culinary school by nature, you become very curious because you're stimulated on a day-to-day basis. There's like chocolate workshops happening and then the chocolate exams. And I didn't know that there were so many different variations of things that you could do with chocolate. And it's such an art form as well. It added on layers to what I was curious about, but now became passionate about. And curiosity, I find even more beautiful than like passion, because curiosity, it drives you to a place where it opens up ideas that I didn't even know I had for myself. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe where now the passion starts to happen, because now I'm like, ooh, my curiosity led me to this. And that's exactly what happened. So it was just, it's probably one of the most, to this day, I tell everybody it was probably one of the most beautiful years as far as what I learned professionally about food.
It does sound pretty awesome.
Well, it's a very animated experience. Like, you have the chefs every day with their, you know, chef hats, and everything is super precise. It's a militant in a lot of ways in the kitchen.
And yeah, like scientific and yeah, it's a serious environment.
Yeah. And then you go to Rangis and you're getting all those fresh foods in the morning. And then you're learning about like seasonality, which was so wonderful for me because I never really had heard that before. I never heard about eating seasonal foods, really.
Wow. Well, I mean, you're going to make a lot of people very envious. I mean, it sounds like a pretty amazing experience that you could have as a food lover, to be working at the Cordon Bleu and to have that kind of exposure and that education while also earning a living. What do you think you learned as this was happening to you that you wanted more of and also less of in your life?
You know, I think what I learned more of was people skills, because I was dealing with a lot of students that were coming from different countries, from Chile, from Mexico, from the UK, from India. And though food was such the binding aspect of our time at Cordon Bleu, the relationships and understanding why people were coming to look, you know, at this culinary school to learn certain things or wanting to open up their restaurants, that was something also new that opened up. And that was really something that I started to learn. I wanted to get better at on understanding the stories of these people and why they were coming to this culinary school in France and why they were wanting to do a program around restaurant management or pastry or cuisine. So food was great, and it will still always be my number one space where I feel so safe and so continue to be very curious about, because I still don't know much about it. But the relationships and the communication that I was building with these students was also very revealing to who I was becoming, because I started to realize that I love their stories more than I was loving anything else now.
What do you think you were looking for in their stories in particular?
I was curious to know why they were coming to this school and a place that cost, you know, a significant amount of money, and why they were doing it. Like, what are you expecting out of this? Where do you want to go? What is your goal? What are your dreams? Because this is something that isn't quick. It's not a 1 week thing. The students that I was dealing with specifically were committing to a year process of really kind of changing their lives. And what was amazing, Ziva, was I was dealing with people that were like 50. And then the next day I was dealing with someone that had just turned 21 and decided to, you know, knew out the bat that this was what they wanted to do. And then I was dealing with someone and having a conversation with someone who had lived this really rich and beautiful life as a doctor, but then 50 was found themselves so empty professionally, or empty in a space where they felt like they hadn't really done what they wanted to do. So they end up quitting this professional aspect of, you know, their career to pursue something in France and decide to go to a culinary school. And that shifted something for me where I was like, oh my God, these stories are even more interesting than the food itself. This is now not just going to culinary school. And I was exposed to that for 4 years on a daily basis, on understanding and being with them throughout their whole time there. And sometimes it was great. Sometimes it was really bad. So I dealt with all those experiences. And I think that eventually is what led me to really understand who I was becoming, and that I was someone that was very story-driven. And I wanted to understand the impact our decisions and choices were having on us, mainly when you make such a big decision to come to France where you maybe don't speak the language, but you're in a pursuit of a higher goal for yourself and you're willing to experience this, you know, through food in a way.
Wow. It sounds like your eye is and your ear is starting to become more and more developed in search of the information that is going to help you understand why someone would make such a big life shift in pursuit of a goal that is not just about food, but food is somehow a catalyst. It's an undercurrent. It's the opportunity to go and explore and maybe make an impact and make a shift somehow that's meaningful for these people. But it's not the end game. It's part of the ingredients, but it's like looking for the information of what's motivating them, what's driving them to make such a big shift in their lives.
Well, also the theme of fulfillment was coming up. You know, there was a lady, this conversation will always stay so important to me because she had been diagnosed with kind of a life-threatening disease. And through many years of treatment, you know, the doctor said, you know, it looks like it's getting better and you might be able to travel. And eventually she was able to, and she was able to go to culinary school in France. And it was, she said that it had been the most fulfilling 2 years of her life. And it wasn't about the food, but it was the fact that she had always had this itch to travel, to go to France, to learn about French cuisine, to maybe one day have her own cafe. And the fact that she was able to do this, knowing that her time was so limited, was so, it just was, I guess it's a powerful statement that, and it's someone revealing this to you. And so you honor that you're part of their that season of their life. And so those stories really were what was highlighted at my time there. And they became very common. And a beautiful part of that adventure.
So a little theme of it's, you know, it's people sharing their stories and the pursuit of fulfillment. You were mentioning back earlier with the people who are coming into the supermarket, kind of telling about their stories, food and stories and fulfillment. It's really interesting. Yeah. Those, the connections there. So when I know that, I don't know when this happened specifically, but I know that there was a big shift in your personal life and that you and your husband of 13 years decided to split and you moved into a small apartment. And you mentioned that this downsized existence and specifically the table that you ate at inspired the name of your platform, this food media platform that you created to share and document your favorite food establishments and travel adventures called Little Life Table. So can you tell us what that transition was like for you, having come here with a Frenchman, being married, establishing yourself here, and then deciding that it was time to move on from that relationship, and also how that project maybe paved the way for what was coming next?
Yeah, well, first of all, I was never married.
Oh, you were never married?
No. I was never married. And he was never my husband. We were just in a very long, committed relationship for 13 years. But in France, you know, you can have that status where you can, you know, you're together and you're paxed or
okay,
something.
So you guys were paxed?
Yeah, we were paxed, but we were never married or any officially. And we were definitely, you know, on that road, on the road to like get married. And it just, it didn't work and it was okay. And I just remember that moment where we decided that it was just the end of the road for us. And he's such an incredible person to this day. He's a very good friend of mine, but it's just that road came to an end. But that experience with this person was also, it's another a wonderful podcast episode because I learned so much about from that relationship. There were so many ups and so many downs, and I made so many mistakes, and we both were just, you know, young, but so in love and wanted to make it work so badly, but it didn't. And when it didn't work, it was a very difficult time for me. I really struggled because I was suddenly found myself in navigating things all on my own. And I had really counted on someone else to help me through, do so many of the day-to-day things and admin things and relied on emotionally. And now it was just me, and it was hard, and it was, I didn't know. I had no idea how things were going to work out. I just knew that I wasn't ready to leave Paris, but I didn't know how I was going to make any of this work. So, but everything, Ziva, fell into place. And when I look back on that, I'm like, wow, it's just wild, because I moved out and we were, you know, living in this nice apartment together, and I was very grateful for everything physically in that relationship, because when you're a foreigner and those things are already, you know, there for you, you don't realize that when they're gone, you're like, oh my God, now I got to go and figure out my apartment situation and all that. And it was me. It was just all me. I had to figure it out. I found this apartment, a dream, little tiny apartment that a friend of mine was giving up. And it was months and months of looking. And the minute that I had seen this apartment, I was like, I know I'm going to live here, because I'd went to go visit her. And then by chance, about a month later, she's like, something happened. And she's like, I have to leave. So I moved into this apartment. It was down the street from Cordon Bleu, and it was perfect. At that time, it served me perfectly. It was so little, but it was so perfect for me. And when I was in my relationship, we loved throwing dinner parties. And we had this large table where people would come over and we'd be able to have like 10 people over, and I'd be cooking and everyone had a place to sit. Now in this new apartment, I literally had no space. However, it came with this little tiny table that was already furnished in the apartment. But every time, every year, every month, every week, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go get a larger table. I am not going to host on this little tiny table, because if there's enough space for maximum two or three people, two on a good time, if I cleaned it up. A year went by, 2 years went by, and I never got a new table. And around the third year, I made a decision where I was like, I don't need a new table, because something had shifted inside of me. That little table, Ziva, I didn't even have this name for my Instagram or anything. It just served me so well. People would come over, my girlfriends would come over, my guy friends would come over, and we'd talk about divorce. We talk about job problems. We talk about managers. We talk about friendship breakups. We talk about all the good things, all the bad things that were happening, all the different shifts in our lives. And that little table would just work. It was just the only little thing, and it served me so well, and everything fit. All the little things we needed, we made it work. And it was actually a much more intimate environment. And ever since then, I was convinced that I just, whatever I had, I knew I could work with it. And that's exactly what happened in that little apartment. And that little table, just, it became a very big and deep metaphor for how I wanted to kind of navigate my life. And that's why it was called Little Life Table. I never got a bigger table. To this day, I live in an apartment. I have a little table and I just like it. I like the intimacy around it. And yeah, that was the name. That's where it kind of originated from.
Well, I love this idea of first that you were able to kind of trust that the relationship had come to an end, but there was no, it wasn't an implosion or explosion. It was that there was a transition that seems kind of elegant and civil and...
Yeah, I think it had to be, because it had to be. The decision came from me. The last year, you know, of our relationship, it was hard. I was starting to notice things about myself that I didn't like. And I was behaving in certain ways with myself where I was feeling not myself. And I, just growing up with parents who kind of, you know, really supported me in trusting who I was becoming and being very intuitive. Intuition has played a big role in my life. Mm-hmm. And whenever something is shifting, I feel something happening. And if I don't listen to it, my life falls apart, and it's happened. Mm-hmm. And I didn't listen to it in that relationship. We should have broken up, and it wasn't, there was nothing that was done that was bad. There was no cheating or anything like that had happened. But what had happened was me, I was shifting away. And so was he. We were going in different directions, and I wasn't listening to it for a few years. And so when you don't listen to that in a relationship, you both are not going to be the best versions of yourself. And I had become a really not great version of myself that last year. And there was a lot of arguments. There was a lot of fighting. And I didn't like what that was, the energy that was stimulating inside of my body.
There's so much wisdom and self-knowing that I've always admired in you, and the way that you talk about how you make decisions, that you come back to yourself and are able to trust what you feel and kind of navigate along with the, even if you don't know what the outcome is going to be, you know, further down the line, you know how to connect with the information within you to guide you through difficult decisions. But it's not something that's common. I think that I don't know exactly how you were able to develop this in yourself, but it's a real gift that you have to trust in your knowing so deeply.
Yeah, that comes from my parents, specifically my dad. When my mother passed away, my dad built this extremely beautiful ritual to cope with that. And I remember being a part of that and from observing it. And my mom and dad were in love, like in love to this day. You know, my dad is still in love with her. He has a photo of her wherever he, you know, in his pocket. And him having to deal with the loss of something so of that magnitude helped me to understand that I would be okay with challenges in life. And I've been very challenged, and I have not always been this way. It's because of a breakup of 13 years. I had to learn very much navigating things on my own. And, you know, I say that, but there's also so many other aspects of life that have been difficult. I'm from India and I grew up there, and I know what it looks like when people don't have enough, and things can be very hard. Because I also grew up in a large family, I think I've always seen so many different scenarios of how life could be very difficult and challenging, and how life could also be good. Mm. But I've always felt very attracted to the harder aspects of life from a very young age. And I have not been good with it. I was really bad at it. Like if something bad would happen, I would not know how to navigate it. I would usually typically need someone to lean on, or call a friend and say, can you help me out? And it wasn't until then, until those resources really were not available to me, that I suppose you have to figure it out. Like, you are in that really dark space. And I've been in those dark spaces for like weeks and months. And I'm like, I don't know how to get out of this. And I suppose the concrete thing that you do is something inside of you tells, like, there's a better, there's more. Other people have dealt with worse things. You need to figure this out. And then maybe you start reading something. Maybe it's a conversation. And I decided and realized I liked having those healthier conversations with myself. Mm. And I think we've all heard this, the most important relationship you have is with yourself. And though that never meant something to me, for a long time I would hear it. I didn't really understand it. It's now that I really understand it. I see it in my dad, in his daily ritual, about how he practices a lot of gratitude and a lot of love towards life. I see it with my friends. I see it with how my mom used to behave with other people. And those little scenarios have just kind of bled into me and my kind of DNA. And I think that's, I believe where it comes from, and also just how I want to live and want to make sure that the next challenge with life, I want to know that I'm going to be somewhat okay, you know, because it's hard. Like, life is hard. So I've been doing it alone for a long time. And so I need to, you know, I need to make sure that I'm okay if something else was to happen again.
Well, it sounds like you have the tools. You have a lot of different tools that allow you to get perspective and connect to you what's essential to you and to move through difficult phases. And going back to the table, there's something symbolic, I think, about the smallness of it, the intimacy of it, and almost in a way like a sort of reconstructive element behind it, where if something is so vast and oversized, then it's hard to find where your place is. It's almost like, where am I supposed to be in this vastness? But by bringing things closer to you, and just being like, okay, well, there are two seats. I'm going to sit in one of those seats.
Yeah. You know, have you ever sat at those really long tables at like a dinner where you've been invited to? Right away, I don't know why, but it almost feels overwhelming to me, because I'm like, wait, there's so many people here. And at this table, it's not even the people, it's just, it's so long. And so obviously, you're talking to the people that are just kind of sitting next to you. But it's, again, just you're limited, right? Like, it's in this long table and you're seeing other places, but there's something about a little round table that's tiny. You know, I don't know if you ever watched the Actors Studio, but they also do this round table during like Oscars and during Cannes. And it's just a minimum of like four, maximum like five people. And they're around this little table. And the conversations are just different. And they talk about it. And they talk about that intimacy of the size of that table. So,
yeah, it's super interesting. Well, it's a fascinating segue to what I wanted to talk to you about, which is the intimacy in the videos you create. Because you really kind of close the gap. I get the impression that you're just like closing the physical gap, the space between what you're presenting and who and the way that the observer feels about whatever it is that you're presenting.
Right.
So you have a tendency, I'm thinking about this one video that you have that I think I've watched it like 1,000 times.
Oh my God.
It's so meditative. It's you're unraveling the wrapper of a petite Suisse.
Oh,
you like
yeah.
take out a little plate. It's teeny, teeny plate. We're back in the teeny. It's a teeny, teeny little saucer. Mm-hmm. You get out the petite Suisse, which is a very small size, dense fromage blanc. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh,
fromage blanc?
Okay. Yeah.
You unravel the wrapper. I think you show how you get it out, which is not very evident if you haven't been raised with them. So you're just like showing how you do it. You take the wrapper off and then you get out some little nuts and you like crush the nuts and you have like beautiful manicured fingers.
Gotta have that for the video. Gotta have it.
And it's just like so delicate. You put your little like, you crumble your little noisette on top and then you pour some honey and then you just like dip it. And it's like, it's so, there's something about the ritual, the detail, the smallness of the gestures and the importance of the gestures that it almost feels sacred.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you just said this, because when friends come over, the littlest thing, I will serve it to you in a beautiful way, because it's so lovely. It's so lovely. It feels so cared for. And I like that a lot. And again, I think this might go back to my work at the culinary school, presenting something in a beautiful way or taking more care of it. Doesn't it taste a little bit better? Doesn't it just feel like, oh, you just added you sprinkled some nuts and some honey and you're serving in this. I like it. It makes my life feel a little bit more fun. I would say that's what it is fun. Yeah.
I feel like it's an expression of love. It's a real, there's taking that time and taking the attention to the small. There's like a real strong presence in the connection between what you're doing and who it's being offered to. And
yeah.
I don't know. There's something I know that you have your own rituals. You talked about your dad having his rituals.
Yeah.
How might that connect to some of the rituals and routines and even maybe small appreciations for things that you observed growing up that have maybe infused their way into?
That is such a great question, Zivo. Wow, your questions are amazing. So good. So self-reflective. I grew up with parents that prayed a lot. And what I mean by that in general is very open. There was no sense of like, you need to absolutely do this. Not at all. And when I mean prayer, it was just, you know, when something good would happen, it was like, oh, thank you so much. I just remember hearing that. My grandma was like that. My grandfather was like that. And I don't think you appreciate it when you're younger. I don't know when you appreciate it. I don't know what it takes. I know that what it took for me was many, many dark, challenging moments for me to very much being like, oh my God, this little thing worked out. Thank you. And that really started to happen like after my breakup and being so long on my own, not having any family in France, that a sense of daily thank you. I'm so glad this little thing worked out. I'm so glad that at the post office, this person like smiled because I've been having literally such a bad day, but they helped me figure out how the machine works so I can send this, you know, admin stuff that I need to send. It is literally that little. And I started to pay a lot of attention of how that was making me feel. When I say pay attention, what I mean is like, I'd walk out of that post office where someone made me feel good or just assisted me. And I'd be like, oh, life feels a little gentler. And then it got deeper and deeper. I'd talk to friends who maybe had a bad day and I was like, but this happened and that feels like it could be really good, right? And slightly focusing my attention on the things that were going right. Because so much is always going wrong in life. It really is, but there is so much that I started to feel was going right. And the more that started to happen and the more conversations that I reflected on with my mom and dad and how they lived, I just remember, I was like, wait, that is a form of actually really attracting good things in your life. Like genuinely, it is not the sense of like, I wake up positive. Absolutely not. But I do feel extremely grateful for the very small things in my life. And I would say it's gotten to a place where it's extremely heightened now that it's not a ritual that I do, but I feel so grateful when anything that feels so seamless and easy just happens. I'm grateful that I come home and I was able to come home on a walk safely and nothing bad happened. I feel grateful that I can go get groceries and cook and make these videos. It's these little things because I know people and I know that this, because this happened to me when things get taken away from you, the easiness of doing this podcast or anything, it's threatening to your well-being because I live in this very, it's a sense of like gratefulness for everything that I have because I know things can get taken away because it happened, you know, my mom got, you know, plucked away very unexpectedly. And I could have gone down a very different path, which at one moment I think I was on. I was like, oh my God. Was a little self-destructive for a few months. And then I just realized I come from a very grateful lineage of grandparents and parents. And I think throughout the day, I'm praying all throughout the day, throughout the day. I'm like saying, thanks. I'm just like, thank you so much. Thank you so much for letting me have this opportunity to do this podcast, to have food, to be able to walk down the street and go get a cafe, to, you know, call my family in India, to have these mics. It's very minuscule now though. It's gotten to a point where it's like little things and it makes me very happy. It makes me so happy throughout my day where I'm like, this is so good. Everything's, even when it's bad, it's good. There's going to be something that I'm going to figure out by myself and I'm going to figure this out. What's the other alternative?
Right. It sounds like you're making a conscious choice. And maybe it's also because the practice is so set. You know, one of the things that it's hard for a lot of people to do is recognize that their mindset is something that they can shift, and that putting small practices into place will aggregate over time to make you feel more and more grateful and in control and confident that things are kind of evolving in the way that is bringing you whatever kind of emotion you're looking to enhance. You know, it's reminding me a lot about Adjorie's book, Joie.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and she, there isn't a direct beeline from, you know, her mom passed away quite suddenly when she was 12. And one of the anecdotes that she talks about is how her mother never wanted to use the good china because it was always supposed to be for another time. And how that has become, in a way, like a metaphor for you never know what's down the road. And appreciate what you do have and what you have access to. And it's those small gestures of taking out the lovely china, you know, inviting people over, making a beautiful meal, you know, having a wonderful conversation, that those are the things that over, you know, compound when you start to acknowledge them, bloom into a great life. And it's not necessarily the striving for more money, more success, the status. It's those little moments that are really what we're, as we as humans are programmed to really deeply seek out.
Yeah, it's so beautiful what you just said, explaining about, you know, Joie, the book by Adjorie. Can we talk about anything on here? I say that because, I just want to make sure I'm, you know, not triggering anybody, but it's something about death. Can I talk about it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I recently got this app. This might feel so weird for other people. Again, it's, you know, if it's triggering for anybody who has dealt with death, maybe you might want not to listen to this next part, but it's called We Croak. It's an app. And throughout the day, three times a day, it sends you this quote, a philosophical quote or someone about death. It's a reminder. It's a positive thing. It's not in a negative way. It's a very much a positive form of death, philosophical way of death. And I get it throughout the day three times. And it is a reminder of the temporary nature of life. And I think when my mother passed away, that's what happened, where I would do the same. I was like, I'm not going to wear this shirt that I got because I'm going to save it for a special occasion. It disappeared when she passed away, that mentality for me. And I started to think a lot more about death when my mother passed away, and how temporary this life is and this day is and this time is, that actually for me, knowing that it's temporary, I am the type of person that does like that kind of quote that suddenly says, hey, because it like brings everything into perspective and brings it down and makes me realize whatever I'm dealing with today is very temporary. Doesn't mean you abandon your day-to-day tasks and needs, but it does clarify the importance of that day. And so for me, death is something I think about almost on a daily basis, many times throughout my day. And in some ways, I think that's where my thank you, the gratitude, I feel lucky. I feel so good. And for the life you've given me in general. So I think death has been a theme for my mentality to a certain extent.
I want to talk about your new baby, Life on Time, the podcast that you created that we coincidentally realized I was like, reached out to you about this podcast. You were like, and I have a podcast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're definitely on the same wavelength. Tell me about, well, it's interesting. Now I'm reading additional meanings into the title Life on Time. Where did you come up with this concept, and how is the podcast allowing you to expand your storytelling repertoire, your curiosity repertoire? What is this podcast about for you?
The name is called Life on Time because first of all, I had no name for this, and I had already started doing interviews with people that I thought had really great stories. When I was interviewing them during the story process that they were, you know, when they were revealing what was going on in their life, really genuinely and almost in a creepy way, it felt like everything was happening to them on time. And then when I look back on my story, as challenging as it was with everything that has kind of happened, which we haven't really, you know, been able to go through on this podcast, but a future one, everything happened on time. It really did. And it just felt like a very appropriate title for this podcast. I was really struggling to figure out what to name it. And then when I looked back at the first three interviews that I did, I asked all those interviewees, I said, did you feel like things were happening on time? Because it's not a question I specifically asked you in the podcast. They said, yes. They said it felt like that moment that I was supposed to move to Paris happened on time. It couldn't have happened earlier because da da da, or it could have, but it didn't. And so the storytelling on that podcast is something I'm still really struggling with. I need to understand it better. So these are my formative years as a podcaster.
Well, thank you for getting vulnerable here.
Yeah.
And during this early phase of this new project. I just have a couple of wrap it up questions. So based on everything we've explored, our little journey in your journey, what stood out the most to you or maybe resonated the most with you?
In my journey?
In this conversation.
I think realizing how impactful, how deeply impactful actually my father or my parents' actual daily rituals have been on me. I think I've always known it, but the fact that we really, you talked about it and you asked, what do you do on a daily basis? Where does it come from? Again, you might know something, but when you speak it out loud, you're like, oh, actually that is where it comes from. Like that's, or it originated from there. And so I think when you asked me that and hearing myself say that, it helped me also to understand that that's where this is coming from.
Mm. And what might that reveal to you about the person you're becoming more of?
Oh my God, Ziva, I don't know how this is going to sound, but I love who I'm becoming. I just got back from a trip to Montpellier. I was with some friends and I just really like who I'm becoming. I love myself so much. And I say that in a really safe way because I like how I'm thinking. I like how I love the people around me. And I've realized I've brought those people to me and I want to be around those people. But I have so much more to like become better at, which is the very, very cool part now. Like that's the really interesting part. So having this conversation with you and someone like you, you know, I've also really, I love that you're doing these podcasts because I know that you're going to bring a layer of a depth that I'm also very curious about. And I love hearing how you're going to, you know, reveal these stories. I already loved this podcast. So I'm very, very excited for your, you know, to hear everything else that you're going to be doing coming up. But yeah, I like who I'm becoming a lot.
I love that. I love that. All right.
It just feels good. It feels good.
We could not end on a more exuberant note.
Great.
I love that so much. And so thank you so much again for taking this adventure with me to this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel so, so honored to be on this podcast. I'm very excited though, Ziva, because I know you're going to like, it's going to be very, I love that you're doing this.
Yeah. So yeah. Do I. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.